going back to the cradle of society, the orator painted those fierce times when men lived on acorns in the heart of woods. Then they had left off the skins of beasts, had put on cloth, tilled the soil, planted the vine. Was this a good? And in this discovery was there not more of injury than of gain? Monsieur de Roseraie set himself this problem. From magnetism, little by little, Rodolphe had come to affinities. And while the president was citing Cincinnatus and his plough, Diocletian planting his cabbages, and the emperors of China inaugurating the year by the sowing of seed, the young man was explaining to the young woman that these irresistible attractions find their cause in some previous state of existence. "Thus we," he said, "why did we come to know one another? What chance willed it? It was because across the infinite, like two streams that flow but to unite, our special bents of mind had driven us towards each other." And he seized her hand. She did not withdraw it. "For good farming generally," cried the president. "Just now, for example, when I went to your house, to Monsieur Bizard of Quincampoix, did I know I should accompany you? 70 francs. 100 times I wished to go, and I followed you. I remained. Manures, and I shall remain tonight, tomorrow, all other days, all my life. To Monsieur Caron of Argueil, a gold medal, for I have never in the society of any other person found so complete a charm. To Monsieur Bain of Givry-Saint-Martin, and I shall carry away with me the remembrance of you. For a merino ram, but you will forget me. I shall pass away like a shadow. To Monsieur Bellot of Notre Dame. Oh, no, I shall be something in your thought, in your life, shall I not? Porcine race. Prizes equal to Messrs. Le Hérissay and Coulombourg, 60 francs. Rodolphe was pressing her hand, and he felt it all warm and quivering like a captive dove that wants to fly away. But whether she was trying to take it away, or whether she was answering his pressure, she made a movement with her fingers. He exclaimed, "Oh, I thank you. You do not repulse me. You are good. You understand that I am yours. Let me look at you. Let me contemplate you." A gust of wind that blew in at the window ruffled the cloth on the table, and in the square below all the great caps of the peasant women were uplifted by it, like the wings of white butterflies fluttering. "Use of oil cakes," continued the president. He was hurrying on. "Flemish manure, flax growing, drainage, long leases, domestic service." Rodolphe was no longer speaking. They looked at one another. A supreme desire made their dry lips tremble, and wearily, without an effort, their fingers intertwined. "Catherine Niquez, Elizabeth Leroux of Sustou-la-Guerrière, for 54 years of service at the same farm, a silver medal, value 25 francs. "Where is Catherine Leroux?" repeated the councillor. She did not present herself, and one could hear voices whispering. "Go up! Don't be afraid! Oh, how stupid she is!" "Well, is she there?" cried Tuvache. "Yes, here she is." "Then let her come up." Then there came forward on the platform a little old woman with timid bearing, who seemed to shrink within her poor clothes. On her feet she wore heavy wooden clogs, and from her hips hung a large blue apron. Her pale face, framed in a borderless cap, was more wrinkled than a withered russet apple. And from the sleeves of her red jacket looked out two large hands with knotty joints. The dust of barns, the potash of washing the grease of wool, had so encrusted, roughened, hardened these that they seemed dirty, although they had been rinsed in clear water, and by dint of long service they remained half open, as if to bear humble witness for themselves of so much suffering endured. Something of monastic rigidity dignified her face. Nothing of sadness or of emotion weakened that pale look. In her constant living with animals she had caught their dumbness and their calm. It was the first time that she found herself in the midst of so large a company, and inwardly scared by the flags, the drums, the gentlemen in frock coats, and the order of the councillor, she stood motionless, not knowing whether to advance or run away, nor why the crowd was pushing her and the jury was smiling at her. Thus stood before these radiant bourgeois this half-century of servitude. "Approach, venerable Catherine Niquaise Elizabeth Leroux," said the councillor, who had taken the list of prize-winners from the president, and looking at the piece of paper and the old woman by turns, he repeated in a fatherly tone, "Approach, approach." "Are you deaf?" said Tuvache, fidgeting in his armchair, and he began shouting in her ear, 54 years of service, a silver medal, 25 francs for you." Then, when she had her medal, she looked at it, and a smile of beatitude spread over her face. And as she walked away, they could hear her muttering, "I'll give it to our curé up home to say some masses for me." "What fanaticism!" exclaimed the chemist, leaning across to the notary. The meeting was over. The crowd dispersed, and now that the speeches had been read, each one fell back into his place again, and everything into the old grooves. The masters bullied the servants, and these struck the animals, indolent victors going back to the stalls, a green crown on their horns. The National Guards, however, had gone up to the first floor of the town hall with buns spitted on their bayonets, and the drummer of the battalion carried a basket with bottles. Madame Bovary took Rodolphe's arm. He saw her home. They separated at her door. Then he walked about alone in the meadow while he waited for the time of the banquet. The feast was long, noisy, ill-served. The guests were so crowded that they could hardly move their elbows, and the narrow planks used for forms almost broke down under their weight. They ate hugely. Each one stuffed himself on his own account. Sweat stood on every brow, and a whitish steam like the vapour of a stream on an autumn morning floated above the table between the hanging lamps. Rodolphe, leaning against the calico of the tent, was thinking so earnestly of Emma that he heard nothing. Behind him, on the grass, the servants were piling up the dirty plates. His neighbours were talking. He did not answer them. They filled his glass, and there was silence in his thoughts, in spite of the growing noise. He was dreaming of what she had said, of the line of her lips. Her face, as in a magic mirror, shone on the plates of the shakos. The folds of her gown fell along the walls, and days of love unrolled to all infinity before him in the vistas of the future. He saw her again in the evening during the fireworks, but she was with her husband, Madame Homais, and the druggist, who was worrying about the danger of stray rockets, and every moment he left the company to go and give some advice to Binet. The pyrotechnic pieces sent to Monsieur Tuvache had, through an excess of caution, been shut up in his cellar, and so the damp powder would not light, and the principal set piece, that was to represent a dragon biting his tail, failed completely. Now and then a meagre Roman candle went off. Then the gaping crowd sent up a shout that mingled with the cry of the women, whose waists were being squeezed in the darkness. Emma silently nestled gently against Charles's shoulder. Then, raising her chin, she watched the luminous rays of the rockets against the dark sky. Rodolphe gazed at her in the light of the burning lanterns. They went out, one by one. The stars shone out. A few drops of rain began to fall. She knotted her fichu round her bare head. At this moment the councillor's carriage came out from the inn. His coachman, who was drunk, suddenly dozed off, and one could see from the distance above the hood between the two lanterns the mass of his body that swayed from right to left with the giving of the traces. "Truly," said the druggist, "one ought to proceed most rigorously against drunkenness. I should like to see written up weekly at the door of the town hall on a board ad hoc the names of all those who during the week got intoxicated on alcohol. Besides, with regard to statistics, one would thus have, as it were, public records that one could refer to in case of need. But excuse me," and he once more ran off to the captain. The latter was going back to see his lathe again. "Perhaps you would not do ill," Homais said to him, "to send one of your men, or to go yourself." "Leave me alone," answered the tax collector. "It's all right." "Do not be uneasy," said the druggist, when he returned to his friends. "Monsieur Binet has assured me that all precautions have been taken. No sparks have fallen. The pumps are full. Let us go to rest."
"Ma foi, I want it,"
said Madame Homais, yawning at large. "But never mind, we've had a beautiful day for our fate." Rodolphe repeated in a low voice and with a tender look, "Oh, yes, very beautiful." And having bowed to one another, they separated. 2 days later, in the Fanal de Rouen, there was a long article on the show. Homais had composed it with verve the very next morning. "Why these festoons, these flowers, these garlands? Whither hurries this crowd like the waves of a furious sea under the torrents of a tropical sun pouring its heat upon our heads?" Then he spoke of the condition of the peasants. Certainly the government was doing much, but not enough. "Courage!" he cried to it. "A thousand reforms are indispensable. Let us accomplish them." Then, touching on the entry of the councillor, he did not forget the martial air of our militia, nor our most merry village maidens, nor the bald-headed old men like patriarchs who were there, and of whom some, the remnants of our phalanxes, still felt their hearts beat at the manly sound of the drums. He cited himself among the first of the members of the jury, and he even called attention in a note to the fact that Monsieur Homais, chemist, had sent a memoir on cider to the Agricultural Society. When he came to the distribution of the prizes, he painted the joy of the prize winners in dithyrambic strophes. "The father embraced the son, the brother, the husband, his consort. More than one showed his humble medal with pride, and no doubt when he got home to his good housewife, he hung it up weeping on the modest walls of his cot." About 6 o'clock, a banquet prepared in the meadow of Monsieur Liégeard brought together the principal personages of the fête. The greatest cordiality reigned here. Divers toasts were proposed. Monsieur Louvain, the king, Monsieur Tuvache, the prefect, Monsieur Desrosiers, agriculture, Monsieur Homais, industry and the fine arts, those twin sisters, Monsieur Le Pliché, progress. In the evening, some brilliant fireworks on a sudden illumined the air. One would have called it a veritable kaleidoscope, a real operatic scene, and for a moment our little locality might have thought itself transported into the midst of a dream of the Thousand and One Nights. Let us state that no untoward event disturbed this family meeting. And he added, "Only the absence of the clergy was remarked. No doubt the priests understand progress in another fashion. Just as you please, messieurs the followers of Loyola." Chapter 9. 6 weeks passed. Rodolphe did not come again. At last, one evening, he appeared. The day after the show, he had said to himself, "We mustn't go back too soon. That would be a mistake." And at the end of a week, he had gone off hunting. After the hunting, he had thought it was too late, and then he reasoned thus, "If from the first day she loved me, she must, from impatience to see me again, love me more. Let's go on with it." And he knew that his calculation had been right when, on entering the room, he saw Emma turn pale. She was alone. The day was drawing in. The small muslin curtain along the windows deepened to the twilight, and the gilding of the barometer, on which the rays of the sun fell, shone in the looking-glass between the meshes of the coral. Rodolphe remained standing, and Emma hardly answered his first conventional phrases. "I," he said, "have been busy. I have been ill."
"Seriously?" she cried.
"Well," said Rodolphe, sitting down at her side on a footstool, "no. It was because I did not want to come back."
"Why?"
"Can you not guess?" He looked at her again, but so hard that she lowered her head, blushing. He went on. "Emma."
"Sir?" she said, drawing back a little.
"Ah, you see," replied he in a melancholy voice, "that I was right not to come back. For this name that fills my whole soul and that escaped me, you forbid me to use. Madame Bovary, why all the world calls you thus? Besides, it is not your name, it is the name of another." He repeated, "of another," and he hid his face in his hands. "Yes, I think of you constantly. The memory of you drives me to despair. Ah, forgive me, I will leave you. Farewell. I will go far away, so far that you will never hear of me again. And yet, today I know not what force impelled me towards you, for one does not struggle against heaven.
One cannot resist the smile of angels. One is carried away by that which is beautiful, charming, adorable. It was the first time that Emma had heard such words spoken to herself, and her pride, like one who reposes bathed in warmth, expanded softly and fully at this glowing language. "But if I did not come," he continued, "if I could not see you, at least I have gazed long on all that surrounds you. At night, every night, I arose, I came hither. I watched your house, its glimmering in the moon, the trees in the garden swaying before your window, and the little lamp, a gleam shining through the window panes in the darkness. Ah, you never knew that there, so near you, so far from you, was a poor wretch." She turned towards him with a sob. "Oh, you are good," she said. "No, I love you, that is all. You do not doubt that. Tell me, one word, only one word." And Rodolphe imperceptibly glided from the footstool to the ground. But a sound of wooden shoes was heard in the kitchen, and he noticed the door of the room was not closed. "How kind it would be of you," he went on, rising, "if you would humour a whim of mine." It was to go over her house, he wanted to know it, and Madame Bovary seeing no objection to this, they both rose when Charles came in. "Good morning, doctor," Rodolphe said to him. The doctor, flattered at this unexpected title, launched out into obsequious phrases. Of this, the other took advantage to pull himself together a little. "Madame was speaking to me," he then said, "about her health." Charles interrupted him. He had indeed 1,000 anxieties. His wife's palpitations of the heart were beginning again. Then Rodolphe asked if riding would not be good. "Certainly. Excellent. Just the thing. There's an idea. You ought to follow it up." And as she objected that she had no horse, Monsieur Rodolphe offered one. She refused his offer. He did not insist. Then, to explain his visit, he said that his ploughman, the man of the bloodletting, still suffered from giddiness. "I'll call round," said Bovary. "No, no, I'll send him to you. We'll come. That will be more convenient for you." "Ah, very good. I thank you." And as soon as they were alone, "Why don't you accept Monsieur Boulanger's kind offer?" She assumed a sulky air, invented 1,000 excuses, and finally declared that perhaps it would look odd. "Well, what the deuce do I care for that?" said Charles, making a pirouette. "Health before everything, you are wrong." "And how do you think I can ride when I haven't got a habit?" "You must order one," he answered. The riding habit decided her. When the habit was ready, Charles wrote to Monsieur Boulanger that his wife was at his command and that they counted on his good nature. The next day, at noon, Rodolphe appeared at Charles's door with 2 saddle horses. One had pink rosettes at his ears and a deerskin side saddle. Rodolphe had put on high, soft boots, saying to himself that no doubt she had never seen anything like them. In fact, Emma was charmed with his appearance as he stood on the landing in his great velvet coat and white corduroy breeches. She was ready. She was waiting for him. Justin escaped from the chemist's to see her start, and the chemist also came out. He was giving Monsieur Boulanger a little good advice. "An accident happens so easily. Be careful. Your horses perhaps are mettlesome." She heard a noise above her. It was Félicité drumming on the window panes to amuse little Berthe. The child blew her a kiss. Her mother answered with a wave of her whip. "A pleasant ride," cried Monsieur Homais. "Prudence, above all prudence." And he flourished his newspaper as he saw them disappear. As soon as he felt the ground, Emma's horse set off at a gallop. Rodolphe galloped by her side. Now and then they exchanged a word. Her figure slightly bent, her hand well up and her right arm stretched out, she gave herself up to the cadence of the movement that rocked her in her saddle. At the bottom of the hill, Rodolphe gave his horse its head. They started together at a bound. Then, at the top, suddenly the horses stopped, and her large blue veil fell about her. It was early in October. There was fog over the land. Hazy clouds hovered on the horizon between the outlines of the hills. Others, rent asunder, floated up and disappeared. Sometimes, through a rift in the clouds, beneath a ray of sunshine, gleamed from afar the roofs of Yonville, with the gardens at the water's edge, the yards, the walls, and the church steeple. Emma half closed her eyes to pick out her house, and never had this poor village where she lived appeared so small. From the height on which they were, the whole valley seemed an immense pale lake, sending off its vapour into the air. Clumps of trees here and there stood out like rocks, and the tall lines of the poplars that rose above the mist were like a beach when stirred by the wind. By the side, on the turf between the pines, a brown light shimmered in the warm atmosphere. The earth, ruddy like the powder of tobacco, deadened the noise of their steps, and with the edge of their shoes the horses, as they walked, kicked the fallen fir cones in front of them. Rodolphe and Emma thus went along the skirt of the wood. She turned away from time to time to avoid his look, and then she saw only the pine trunks in lines, whose monotonous succession made her a little giddy. The horses were panting, the leather of the saddles creaked. Just as they were entering the forest, the sun shone out.
"God protects us," said Rodolphe.
"Do you think so?" she said.
"Forward, forward," he continued.
He with his tongue. The two beasts set off at a trot. Long ferns by the roadside caught in Emma's stirrup. Rodolphe leant forward and removed them as they rode along. At other times, to turn aside the branches, he passed close to her, and Emma felt his knee brushing against her leg. The sky was now blue, the leaves no longer stirred. There were spaces full of heather in flower, and plots of violets alternated with the confused patches of the trees that were grey, fawn, or golden-coloured according to the nature of their leaves. Often in the thicket was heard the fluttering of wings, or else the hoarse, soft cry of the ravens flying off amidst the oaks. They dismounted. Rodolphe fastened up the horses. She walked on in front on the moss between the paths. But her long habit got in her way, although she held it up by the skirt. And Rodolphe, walking behind her, saw between the black cloth and the black shoe the fineness of her white stocking that seemed to him as if it were a part of her nakedness. She stopped. "I'm tired," she said. "Come, try again," he went on. "Courage." Then, some 100 paces farther on, she again stopped, and through her veil that fell sideways from her man's hat over her hips, her face appeared in a bluish transparency as if she were floating under azure waves. "But where are we going?" He did not answer. She was breathing irregularly. Rodolphe looked round him, biting his moustache. They came to a larger space where the coppice had been cut. They sat down on the trunk of a fallen tree, and Rodolphe began speaking to her of his love. He did not begin by frightening her with compliments. He was calm, serious, melancholy. Emma listened to him with bowed head and stirred the bits of wood on the ground with the tip of her foot. But at the words, "Are not our destinies now one?"
"Oh, no," she replied. "You know that well. It is impossible."
She rose to go. He seized her by the wrist. She stopped. Then, having gazed at him for a few moments with an amorous and humid look, she said hurriedly,
"Oh, do not speak of it again. Where are the horses? Let us go back."
He made a gesture of anger and annoyance. She repeated,
"Where are the horses? Where are the horses?"
Then, smiling a strange smile, his pupil fixed, his teeth set, he advanced with outstretched arms. She recoiled, trembling. She stammered,
"Oh, you frighten me. You hurt me. Let me go."
"If it must be," he went on, his face changing. And he again became respectful, caressing, timid. She gave him her arm. They went back. He said,
"What was the matter with you? Why? I do not understand. You are mistaken, no doubt. In my soul you are as a Madonna on a pedestal, in a place lofty, secure, immaculate. But I want you for my life. I must have your eyes, your voice, your thought. Be my friend, my sister, my angel."
And he put out his arm around her waist. She feebly tried to disengage herself. He supported her thus as they walked along. But they heard the two horses browsing on the leaves.
"Oh, one moment," said Rodolphe. "Do not let us go. Stay."
He drew her farther on to a small pool where duckweeds made a greenness on the water. Faded water lilies lay motionless between the reeds. At the noise of their steps in the grass, frogs jumped away to hide themselves.
"I am wrong. I am wrong," she said. "I am mad to listen to you."
"Why?"
"Emma, Emma,
"Oh, Rodolphe," said the young woman slowly, leaning on his shoulder. The cloth of her habit caught against the velvet of his coat. She threw back her white neck, swelling with a sigh, and faltering in tears, with a long shudder and hiding her face, she gave herself up to him. The shades of night were falling. The horizontal sun passing between the branches dazzled the eyes. Here and there around her, in the leaves or on the ground, trembled luminous patches, as if hummingbirds flying about had scattered their feathers. Silence was everywhere. Something sweet seemed to come forth from the trees. She felt her heart, whose beating had begun again, and the blood coursing through her flesh like a stream of milk. Then, far away, beyond the wood, on the other hills, she heard a vague, prolonged cry, a voice which lingered, and in silence she heard it mingling like music with the last pulsations of her throbbing nerves. Rodolphe, a cigar between his lips, was mending with his penknife one of the two broken bridles. They returned to Yonville by the same road. On the mud they saw again the traces of their horses side by side, the same thickets, the same stones in the grass. Nothing around them seemed changed. And yet for her something had happened more stupendous than if the mountains had moved in their places. Rodolphe now and again bent forward and took her hand to kiss it. She was charming on horseback, upright, with her slender waist, her knee bent on the mane of her horse, her face somewhat flushed by the fresh air in the red of the evening. On entering Yonville, she made her horse prance in the road. People looked at her from the windows. At dinner, her husband thought she looked well, but she pretended not to hear him when he inquired about her ride, and she remained sitting there with her elbow at the side of her plate between the two lighted candles.
"Emma," he said.
"What?"
"Well, I spent the afternoon at Monsieur Alexandre's. He has an old cob, still very fine, only a little broken-kneed, and that could be bought, I'm sure, for 100 crowns," he added, "and, thinking it might please you, I have bespoken it, bought it. Have I done right? Do tell me."
She nodded her head in assent. Then, a quarter of an hour later, "Are you going out tonight?" she asked.
"Yes, why?"
"Oh, nothing, nothing, my dear."
And as soon as she had got rid of Charles, she went and shut herself up in her room.
At first she felt stunned. She saw the trees, the paths, the ditches, Rodolphe, and she again felt the pressure of his arm, while the leaves rustled and the reeds whistled. But when she saw herself in the glass, she wondered at her face. Never had her eyes been so large, so black, of so profound a depth. Something subtle about her being transfigured her. She repeated, "I have a lover, a lover," delighting at the idea as if a second puberty had come to her. So at last she was to know those joys of love, that fever of happiness of which she had despaired. She was entering upon marvels where all would be passion, ecstasy, delirium. An azure infinity encompassed her. The heights of sentiment sparkled under her thought, and ordinary existence appeared only afar off, down below in the shade through the interspaces of these heights. Then she recalled the heroines of the books that she had read, and the lyric legion of these adulterous women began to sing in her memory with the voices of sisters that charmed her. She became herself, as it were, an actual part of these imaginings, and realized the love dream of her youth, as she saw herself in this type of amorous woman whom she had so envied. Besides, Emma felt a satisfaction of revenge. Had she not suffered enough? But now she triumphed, and the love so long pent up burst forth in full, joyous bubblings. She tasted it without remorse, without anxiety, without trouble. The day following passed with a new sweetness. They made vows to one another. She told him of her sorrows. Rodolphe interrupted her with kisses, and she, looking at him through half-closed eyes, asked him to call her again by her name, to say that he loved her. They were in the forest as yesterday, in the shed of some wooden shoemaker. The walls were of straw, and the roof so low they had to stoop. They were seated side by side on a bed of dry leaves. From that day forth they wrote to one another regularly every evening.
Emma placed her letter at the end of the garden by the river in a fissure of the wall. Rodolphe came to fetch it and put another there that she always found fault with as too short. One morning, when Charles had gone out before daybreak, she was seized with a fancy to see Rodolphe at once. She would go quickly to La Huchette, stay there an hour, and be back again at Yonville while everyone was still asleep. This idea made her pant with desire, and she soon found herself in the middle of the field, walking with rapid steps without looking behind her. Day was just breaking. Emma from afar recognised her lover's house. Its two dovetailed weathercocks stood out black against the pale dawn. Beyond the farmyard there was a detached building that she thought must be the chateau. She entered it as if the doors at her approach had opened wide of their own accord. A large, straight staircase led up to the corridor. Emma raised the latch of a door, and suddenly at the end of the room she saw a man sleeping. It was Rodolphe. She uttered a cry. "You here? You here?" he repeated. "How did you manage to come? Oh, your dress is damp." "I love you," she answered, throwing her arms about his neck. This first piece of daring successful. Now, every time Charles went out early, Emma dressed quickly and slipped on tiptoe down the steps that led to the waterside. But when the plank for the cows was taken up, she had to go by the walls alongside of the river. The bank was slippery. In order not to fall, she caught hold of the tufts of faded wallflowers. Then she went across ploughed fields, in which she sank, stumbling and clogging her thin shoes. Her scarf, knotted round her head, fluttered to the wind in the meadows. She was afraid of the oxen. She began to run. She arrived out of breath, with rosy cheeks, and breathing out from her whole person a fresh perfume of sap, of verdure, of the open air. At this hour Rodolphe still slept. It was like a spring morning coming into his room. The yellow curtains along the windows let a heavy, whitish light enter softly. Emma felt about, opening and closing her eyes, while the drops of dew hanging from her hair formed, as it were, a topaz aureole around her face. Rodolphe, laughing, drew her to him and pressed her to his breast. Then she examined the apartment, opened the drawers of the tables, combed her hair with his comb, and looked at herself in his shaving-glass. Often she even put between her teeth the big pipe that lay on the table by the bed, amongst lemons and pieces of sugar near a bottle of water. It took them a good quarter of an hour to say good-bye. Then Emma cried. She would have wished never to leave Rodolphe. Something stronger than herself forced her to him, so much so that one day, seeing her come unexpectedly, he frowned as one put out. "What is the matter with you?" she said. "Are you ill? Tell me." At last he declared with a serious air that her visits were becoming imprudent, that she was compromising herself. Chapter 10. Gradually Rodolphe's fears took possession of her. At first love had intoxicated her, and she had thought of nothing beyond. But now that he was indispensable to her life, she feared to lose anything of this, or even that it should be disturbed. When she came back from his house, she looked all about her, anxiously watching every form that passed in the horizon, and every village window from which she could be seen. She listened for steps, cries, the noise of the ploughs, and she stopped short, white and trembling more than the aspen leaves swaying overhead. One morning, as she was thus returning, she suddenly thought she saw the long barrel of a carbine that seemed to be aimed at her. It stuck out sideways from the end of a small tub half buried in the grass on the edge of a ditch. Emma, half fainting with terror, nevertheless walked on, and a man stepped out of the tub like a jack-in-the-box. He had gaiters buckled up to the knees, his cap pulled down over his eyes, trembling lips, and a red nose. It was Captain Binet, lying in ambush for wild ducks. "You ought to have called out long ago," he exclaimed. "When one sees a gun, one should always give warning." The tax-collector was thus trying to hide the fright he had had, for a prefectorial order having prohibited duck-hunting except in boats, Monsieur Binet, despite his respect for the laws, was infringing them, and so he every moment expected to see the rural guard turn up. But this anxiety whetted his pleasure, and all alone in his tub he congratulated himself on his luck and on his cuteness.
At sight of Emma, he seemed relieved from a great weight, and at once entered upon a conversation. "It isn't warm, it's nipping." Emma answered nothing. He went on, "And you're out so early?"
"Yes," she said, stammering. "I am just coming from the nurse where my child is."
"Ah, very good, very good. For myself, I am here just as you see me since break of day. But the weather is so muggy that unless one had the bird at the mouth of the gun..."
"Good evening, Monsieur Binet," she interrupted him, turning on her heel.
"Your servant, madame," he replied dryly, and he went back into his tub.
Emma regretted having left the tax collector so abruptly. No doubt he would form unfavourable conjectures. The story about the nurse was the worst possible excuse, everyone at Yonville knowing that the little Bovary had been at home with her parents for a year. Besides, no one was living in this direction. This path led only to La Huchette. Binet, then, would guess whence she came, and he would not keep silence. He would talk, that was certain. She remained until evening, racking her brain with every conceivable lying project, and had constantly before her eyes that imbecile with the game-bag. Charles, after dinner, seeing her gloomy, proposed by way of distraction to take her to the chemist's, and the first person she caught sight of in the shop was the tax collector again. He was standing in front of the counter, lit up by the gleams of the red bottle, and was saying, "Please, give me half an ounce of vitriol." "Justin," cried the druggist, "bring us the sulfuric acid." Then to Emma, who was going up to Madame Homais' room, "No, stay here. It isn't worthwhile going up. She's just coming down. Warm yourself at the stove in the meantime. Excuse me. Good day, doctor." For the chemist much enjoyed pronouncing the word doctor, as if addressing another by it reflected on himself some of the grandeur that he found in it. "Now take care not to upset the mortars. You'd better fetch some chairs from the little room. You know very well that the armchairs are not to be taken out of the drawing-room." And to put his armchair back in its place, he was darting away from the counter, when Binet asked him for half an ounce of sugar acid. "Sugar acid," said the chemist contemptuously. "Don't know it. I'm ignorant of it. But perhaps you want oxalic acid. It is oxalic acid, isn't it?" Binet explained that he wanted a corrosive to make himself some copper water with which to remove rust from his hunting things. Emma shuddered. The chemist began saying, "Indeed, the weather is not propitious on account of the damp." "Nevertheless," replied the tax collector with a sly look, "there are people who like it." She was stifling. "And give me..." "Will he never go?" thought she. "Half an ounce of resin and turpentine, 4 ounces of yellow wax, and 3 half-ounces of animal charcoal, if you please, to clean the varnished leather of my togs." The druggist was beginning to cut the wax when Madame Homais appeared, Irma in her arms, Napoleon by her side, and Athalie following. She sat down on the velvet seat by the window, and the lad squatted down on a footstool, while his eldest sister hovered round the juju box near her papa. The latter was filling funnels and corking phials, sticking on labels, making up parcels. Around him all was silent. Only from time to time were heard the weights jingling in the balance, and a few low words from the chemist giving directions to his pupil.
"And how's the little woman?" suddenly asked Madame Homais.
"Silence!" exclaimed her husband, who was writing down some figures in his waste-book.
"Why didn't you bring her?" she went on in a low voice. "Hush, hush," said Emma, pointing with her finger to the druggist. But Binet, quite absorbed in looking over his bill, had probably heard nothing. At last he went out. Then Emma, relieved, uttered a deep sigh.
"How hard you are breathing," said Madame Homais.
"Well, you see, it's rather warm," she replied.
So the next day they talked over how to arrange their rendezvous. Emma wanted to bribe her servant with a present, but it would be better to find some safe house at Yonville. Rodolphe promised to look for one. All through the winter, 3 or 4 times a week, in the dead of night, he came to the garden. Emma had on purpose taken away the key of the gate, which Charles thought lost. To call her, Rodolphe threw a sprinkle of sand at the shutters. She jumped up with a start, but sometimes he had to wait, for Charles had a mania for chatting by the fireside, and he would not stop. She was wild with impatience. If her eyes could have done it, she would have hurled him out at the window. At last she would begin to undress, then take up a book and go on reading very quietly as if the book amused her. But Charles, who was in bed, called her to come too. "Come now, Emma," he said, "it is time." "Yes, I'm coming," she answered. Then, as the candles dazzled him, he turned to the wall and fell asleep. She escaped, smiling, palpitating, undressed. Rodolphe had a large cloak. He wrapped her in it, and putting his arm round her waist, he drew her without a word to the end of the garden. It was in the arbour, on the same seat of old sticks where formerly Léon had looked at her so amorously on the summer evenings. She never thought of him now. The stars shone through the leafless jasmine branches. Behind them they heard the river flowing, and now and again on the bank the rustling of the dry reeds. Masses of shadow here and there loomed out in the darkness, and sometimes, vibrating with one movement, they rose up and swayed like immense black waves pressing forward to engulf them. The cold of the nights made them clasp closer. The size of their lips seemed to them deeper. Their eyes, that they could hardly see, larger. And in the midst of the silence, low words were spoken that fell on their souls, sonorous, crystalline, and that reverberated in multiplied vibrations. When the night was rainy, they took refuge in the consulting room between the cart shed and the stable. She lighted one of the kitchen candles that she had hidden behind the books. Rodolphe settled down there as if at home. The sight of the library, of the bureau, of the whole apartment, in fine, excited his merriment, and he could not refrain from making jokes about Charles, which rather embarrassed Emma. She would have liked to see him more serious, and even on occasions more dramatic, as, for example, when she thought she heard a noise of approaching steps in the alley. "Someone is coming," she said. He blew out the light. "Have you your pistols?"
"Why?"
"Why, to defend yourself," replied Emma.
"From your husband? Oh, poor devil!"
And Rodolphe finished his sentence with a gesture that said I could crush him with a flip of my finger. She was wonder-stricken at his bravery, although she felt in it a sort of indecency and a naive coarseness that scandalized her. Rodolphe reflected a good deal on the affair of the pistols. If she had spoken seriously, it was very ridiculous, he thought, even odious, for he had no reason to hate the good Charles, not being what is called devoured by jealousy. And on this subject Emma had taken a great vow that he did not think in the best of taste. Besides, she was growing very sentimental. She had insisted on exchanging miniatures. They had cut off handfuls of hair, and now she was asking for a ring, a real wedding ring, in sign of an eternal union. She often spoke to him of the evening chimes, of the voices of nature. Then she talked to him of her mother, hers, and of his mother, his. Rodolphe had lost his 20 years ago. Emma nonetheless consoled him with caressing words, as one would have done a lost child. And she sometimes even said to him, gazing at the moon, "I am sure that above there together they approve of our love." But she was so pretty. He had possessed so few women of such ingenuousness. This love without debauchery was a new experience for him, and drawing him out of his lazy habits, caressed at once his pride and his sensuality. Emma's enthusiasm, which his bourgeois good sense disdained, seemed to him in his heart of hearts charming, since it was lavished on him. Then, sure of being loved, he no longer kept up appearances, and, insensibly, he changed his ways. He had no longer, as formerly, words so gentle that they made her cry, nor passionate caresses that made her mad, so that their great love, which engrossed her life, seemed to lessen beneath her like the water of a stream absorbed into its channel, and she could see the bed of it. She would not believe it. She redoubled in tenderness, and Rodolphe concealed his indifference less and less. She did not know if she regretted having yielded to him, or whether she did not wish, on the contrary, to enjoy him the more. The humiliation of feeling herself weak was turning to rancour, tempered by their voluptuous pleasures. It was not affection, it was like a continual seduction. He subjugated her. She almost feared him. Appearances, nevertheless, were calmer than ever, Rodolphe having succeeded in carrying out the adultery after his own fancy. And at the end of 6 months, when the springtime came, they were to one another like a married couple, tranquilly keeping up a domestic flame. It was the time of year when old Rouault sent his turkey in remembrance of the setting of his leg. The present always arrived with a letter. Emma cut the string that tied it to the basket and read the following lines. "My dear children, I hope this will find you in good health, and that it will be as good as the others, for it seems to me a little more tender, if I may venture to say so, and heavier. But next time, for a change, I'll give you a turkey cock, unless you have a preference for some dabs. And send me back the hamper, if you please, with the two old ones. I've had an accident with my cart sheds, whose covering flew off one windy night among the trees. The harvest has not been over good either. Finally, I don't know when I shall come to see you. It is so difficult now to leave the house, since I am alone, my poor Emma." Here there was a break in the lines, as if the old fellow had dropped his pen to dream a little while. "For myself, I am very well, except for a cold I caught the other day at the fair at Yvetot, where I had gone to hire a shepherd, having turned away mine because he was too dainty. How we are to be pitied with such a lot of thieves! Besides, he was also rude. I heard from a pedlar who, travelling through your part of the country this winter, had a tooth drawn, that Bovary was as usual working hard. That doesn't surprise me. And he showed me his tooth. We had some coffee together. I asked him if he had seen you, and he said not, but that he had seen two horses in the stables, from which I concluded that business is looking up. So much the better, my dear children, and may God send you every imaginable happiness. It grieves me not yet to have seen my dear little granddaughter Berthe Bovary. I have planted an Orléans plum tree for her in the garden under your room, and I won't have it touched unless it is to have jam made for her by and by, that I will keep in the cupboard for her when she comes. Good-bye, my dear children. I kiss you, my girl, you too, my son-in-law, and the little one on both cheeks. I am, with best compliments, your loving father, Theodore Rouault." She held the coarse paper in her fingers for some minutes. The spelling mistakes were interwoven one with the other, and Emma followed the kindly thought that cackled right through it like a hen half hidden in a hedge of thorns. The writing had been dried with ashes from the hearth, for a little grey powder slipped from the letter onto her dress, and she almost thought she saw her father bending over the hearth to take up the tongs. How long since she had been with him, sitting on the footstool in the chimney corner, where she used to burn the end of a bit of wood in the great flame of the sea sedges. She remembered the summer evenings all full of sunshine. The colts neighed when anyone passed by, and galloped, galloped. Under her window there was a beehive, and sometimes the bees wheeling round in the light struck against her window like rebounding balls of gold. What happiness there had been at that time! What freedom, what hope, what an abundance of illusions! Nothing was left of them now. She had got rid of them all in her soul's life, in all her successive conditions of life, maidenhood, her marriage, and her love, thus constantly losing them all her life through, like a traveller who leaves something of his wealth at every inn along the road. But what then made her so unhappy? What was the extraordinary catastrophe that had transformed her? And she raised her head, looking round as if to seek the cause of that which made her suffer. An April ray was dancing on the china of the whatnot. The fire burned. Beneath her slippers she felt the softness of the carpet. The day was brighter, the air warm, and she heard her child shouting with laughter. In fact, the little girl was just then rolling on the lawn in the midst of the grass that was being turned. She was lying flat on her stomach at the top of a rick. The servant was holding her by her skirt. Lestie Boudoir was raking by her side, and every time he came near she leant forward, beating the air with both her arms. "Bring her to me," said her mother, rushing to embrace her. "How I love you, my poor child, how I love you!" Then, noticing that the tips of her ears were rather dirty, she rang at once for warm water, and washed her, changed her linen, her stockings, her shoes, asked a thousand questions about her health, as if on the return from a long journey, and finally, kissing her again and crying a little, she gave her back to the servant, who stood quite thunderstricken at this excess of tenderness. That evening Rodolphe found her more serious than usual.
That will pass over, he concluded. It's a whim. And he missed 3 rendezvous running. When he did come, she showed herself cold and almost contemptuous. Ah, you're losing your time, my lady. And he pretended not to notice her melancholy sighs nor the handkerchief she took out. Then Emma repented. She even asked herself why she detested Charles, if it had not been better to have been able to love him. But he gave her no opportunities for such a revival of sentiment, so that she was much embarrassed by her desire for sacrifice when the druggist came just in time to provide her with an opportunity. Chapter 11. He had recently read a eulogy on a new method for curing club foot, and as he was a partisan of progress, he conceived the patriotic idea that Yonville, in order to keep to the fore, ought to have some operations for strephopody or club foot. For, said he to Emma, what risk is there? See, and he enumerated on his fingers the advantages of the attempt, success, almost certain relief, and beautifying of the patient, a celebrity acquired by the operator. Why, for example, should not your husband relieve poor Hippolyte of the Lion d'Or? Note that he would not fail to tell about his cure to all the travellers, and then, Homais lowered his voice and looked round him, who is to prevent me from sending a short paragraph on the subject to the paper, eh? Goodness me, an article gets about, it is talked of, it ends by making a snowball, and who knows, who knows? In fact, Bovary might succeed. Nothing proved to Emma that he was not clever, and what a satisfaction for her to have urged him to a step by which his reputation and fortune would be increased. She only wished to lean on something more solid than love. Charles, urged by the druggist and by her, allowed himself to be persuaded. He sent to Rouen for Dr. Duval's volume, and every evening, holding his head between both hands, plunged into the reading of it. While he was studying Equinus, Varus, and Valgus, that is to say, catastrostrophopody, endostrophopody, and exostrophopody, or better, the various turnings of the foot downwards, inwards, and outwards, with the hypostrophopody and anastrophopody, otherwise torsion downwards and upwards, Monsieur Homais, with all sorts of arguments, was exhorting the lad at the inn to submit to the operation. "You will scarcely feel probably a slight pain. It is a simple prick, like a little bloodletting, less than the extraction of certain corns." Hippolyte, reflecting, rolled his stupid eyes. "However," continued the chemist, "it doesn't concern me. It's for your sake, for pure humanity. I should like to see you, my friend, rid of your hideous caudication, together with that waddling of the lumbar regions, which, whatever you say, must considerably interfere with you in the exercise of your calling." Then Homais represented to him how much jollier and brisker he would feel afterwards, and even gave him to understand that he would be more likely to please the women, and the stable-boy began to smile heavily. Then he attacked him through his vanity. "Aren't you a man? Hang it, what would you have done if you had had to go into the army, to go and fight beneath the standard? Ah, Hippolyte!" And Homais retired, declaring that he could not understand this obstinacy, this blindness in refusing the benefactions of science. The poor fellow gave way, for it was like a conspiracy. Binet, who never interfered with other people's business, Madame Lefrancois, Artemise, the neighbours, even the mayor, Monsieur Tuvache, everyone persuaded him, lectured him, shamed him. But what finally decided him was that it would cost him nothing. Bovary even undertook to provide the machine for the operation. This generosity was an idea of Emma's, and Charles consented to it, thinking in his heart of hearts that his wife was an angel. So, by the advice of the chemist, and after 3 fresh starts, he had a kind of box made by the carpenter with the aid of the locksmith, that weighed about 8 pounds, and in which iron, wood, sheet iron, leather, screws, and nuts had not been spared. But to know which of Hippolyte's tendons to cut, it was necessary first of all to find out what kind of club foot he had. He had a foot forming almost a straight line with the leg, which however did not prevent it from being turned in, so that it was an equinus together with something of a varus, or else a slight varus with a strong tendency to equinus.
But with this Aquinas, wide in foot like a horse's hoof, with rugose skin, dry tendons, and large toes, on which the black nails looked as if made of iron, the clubfoot ran about like a deer from morn till night. He was constantly to be seen on the place, jumping round the carts, thrusting his limping foot forwards. He seemed even stronger on that leg than the other. By dint of hard service, it had acquired, as it were, moral qualities of patience and energy, and when he was given some heavy work, he stood on it in preference to its fellow. Now, as it was in Aquinas, it was necessary to cut the tendo Achillis, and if need were, the anterior tibial muscle could be seen to afterwards for getting rid of the virus, for the doctor did not dare to risk both operations at once. He was even trembling already for fear of injuring some important region that he did not know. Neither Ambrose Paré, applying for the first time since Celsus after an interval of 15 centuries a ligature to an artery, nor Dupuytren, about to open an abscess in the brain, nor Jean Soule, when he first took away the superior maxilla, had hearts that trembled, hands that shook, minds so strained as Monsieur Bovary, when he approached Hippolyte, his tenotome between his fingers. And, as at hospitals, nearby on a table lay a heap of lint, with waxed thread, many bandages, a pyramid of bandages, every bandage to be found at the druggist's. It was Monsieur Homais who since morning had been organizing all these preparations, as much to dazzle the multitude as to keep up his illusions. Charles pierced the skin. A dry crackling was heard. The tendon was cut, the operation over. Hippolyte could not get over his surprise, but bent over Bovary's hands to cover them with kisses. "Come, be calm," said the druggist. "Later on you will show your gratitude to your benefactor." And he went down to tell the result to 5 or 6 inquirers who were waiting in the yard, and who fancied that Hippolyte would reappear walking properly. Then Charles, having buckled his patient into the machine, went home, where Emma, all anxiety, awaited him at the door. She threw herself on his neck, they sat down to table, he ate much, and at dessert he even wanted to take a cup of coffee, a luxury he only permitted himself on Sundays when there was company. The evening was charming, full of prattle, of dreams together. They talked about their future fortune, of the improvements to be made in their house. He saw people's estimation of him growing, his comforts increasing, his wife always loving him. And she was happy to refresh herself with a new sentiment, healthier, better, to feel at last some tenderness for this poor fellow who adored her. The thought of Rodolphe for one moment passed through her mind, but her eyes turned again to Charles. She even noticed with surprise that he had not bad teeth. They were in bed when Monsieur Homais, in spite of the servant, suddenly entered the room, holding in his hand a sheet of paper just written. It was the paragraph he intended for the Fanal de Rouen. He brought it to them to read. "Read it yourself," said Bovary. He read, "Despite the prejudices that still invest a part of the face of Europe like a net, the light nevertheless begins to penetrate our country places. Thus, on Tuesday, our little town of Yonville found itself the scene of a surgical operation which is at the same time an act of loftiest philanthropy. Monsieur Bovary, one of our most distinguished practitioners—" "Oh, that is too much, too much," said Charles, choking with emotion. "No, no, not at all. What next? Performed an operation on a club-footed man. I've not used the scientific term, because, you know, in a newspaper everyone would not perhaps understand. The masses must—" "No doubt," said Bovary. "Go on." "I proceed," said the chemist. "Monsieur Bovary, one of our most distinguished practitioners, performed an operation on a club-footed man called Hippolyte Tautin, stableman for the last 25 years at the Hotel of the Lion d'Or, kept by Widow Lefrancois at the Place d'Armes. The novelty of the attempt and the interest incident to the subject had attracted such a concourse of persons that there was a veritable obstruction on the threshold of the establishment. The operation, moreover, was performed as if by magic, and barely a few drops of blood appeared on the skin, as though to say that the rebellious tendon had at last given way beneath the efforts of art. The patient, strangely enough, we affirm it as an eyewitness, complained of no pain. His condition up to the present time leaves nothing to be desired. Everything tends to show that his convalescence will be brief. And who knows, even if at our next village festivity we shall not see our good Hippolyte figuring in the Bacchic dance in the midst of a chorus of joyous boon companions, and thus proving to all eyes by his verve and his capers his complete cure. Honour, then, to the generous savants. Honour